The process is known as apoptosis, or programmed cell death. Every day, billions of your cells die for your benefit, and billions of others clean up the mess. Cells can also die violently, for instance, when infected, but mostly they die because they are told to. Indeed, if not told to live, if not given some kind of active instruction from another cell, cells automatically kill themselves. Cells need a lot of reassurance. When, as occasionally happens, a cell fails to expire in the prescribed manner, but rather begins to divide and proliferate wildly, we call the result cancer. Cancer cells are really just confused cells. Cells make this mistake fairly regularly, but the body has elaborate mechanisms for dealing with it. It is only very rarely that the process spirals out of control. On average, humans suffer one fatal malignancy for each 100 million billion cell divisions. Cancer is bad luck in every possible sense of the term. The wonder of cells is not that things occasionally go wrong, but that they manage everything so smoothly for decades at a stretch. They do so by constantly sending and monitoring streams of messages, a cacophony of messages from all around the body. Instructions, queries, corrections, requests for assistance, updates, notices to divide or expire. Most of these signals arrive by means of couriers called hormones, chemical entities such as insulin, adrenaline, estrogen, and testosterone that convey information from remote outposts like the thyroid and endocrine glands. Still other messages arrive by telegraph from the brain or from regional centers in a process called paracrine signaling. Finally, cells communicate directly with their neighbors to make sure their actions are coordinated. What is perhaps most remarkable is that it is all just random, frantic action, a sequence of endless encounters directed by nothing more than elemental rules of attraction and repulsion. There is clearly no thinking presence behind any of the actions of the cells. It all just happens, smoothly and repeatedly, and so reliably that seldom are we even conscious of it. Yet somehow, all this produces not just order within the cell, but a perfect harmony right across the organism. In ways that we have barely begun to understand, trillions upon trillions of reflexive chemical reactions add up to a mobile, thinking, decision-making you. Or, come to that, a rather less reflective but still incredibly organized dung beetle. Every living thing, never forget, is a wonder of atomic engineering. Indeed, some organisms that we think of as primitive enjoy a level of cellular organization that makes our own look carelessly pedestrian. Disassemble the cells of a sponge, by passing them through a sieve, for instance, then dump them into a solution and they will find their way back together and build themselves into a sponge again. You can do this to them over and over, and they will doggedly reassemble because, like you and me and every other living thing, they have one overwhelming impulse: to continue to be. And that's because of a curious, determined, barely understood molecule that is itself not alive, and for the most part, doesn't do anything at all. We call it DNA. And to begin to understand its supreme importance to science and to us, we need to go back 160 years or so to Victorian England, and to the moment when the naturalist Charles Darwin had what has been called the single best idea that anyone has ever had. And then, for reasons that take a little explaining, locked it away in a drawer for the next 15 years. 25. Darwin's singular notion. In the late summer or early autumn of 1859, Whitwell Elwin, editor of the respected British journal The Quarterly Review, was sent an advance copy of a new book by the naturalist Charles Darwin. Elwin read the book with interest and agreed that it had merit, but feared that the subject matter was too narrow to attract a wide audience. He urged Darwin to write a book about pigeons instead. "Everyone is interested in pigeons," he observed helpfully. Elwin's sage advice was ignored, and On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life was published in late November 1859, priced at 15 shillings. The first edition of 1,250 copies sold out on the first day, It has never been out of print, and scarcely out of controversy in all the time since. Not bad going for a man whose principal other interest was earthworms, and who, but for a single impetuous decision to sail around the world, would very probably have passed his life as an anonymous country parson known for, well, for an interest in earthworms. Charles Robert Darwin was born on February the 12th, 1809, an auspicious date in history, on the same day in Kentucky Abraham Lincoln was born, in Shrewsbury, a sedate market town in the West Midlands of England. His father was a prosperous and well-regarded physician. His mother, who died when Charles was only 8, was the daughter of Josiah Wedgwood of pottery fame. Darwin enjoyed every advantage of upbringing, but continually pained his widowed father with his lackluster academic performance. "You care for nothing but shooting, dogs, and rat-catching, and you will be a disgrace to yourself and all your family," his father wrote in a line that nearly always appears just about here in any review of Darwin's early life. Although his inclination was to natural history, for his father's sake, he tried to study medicine at Edinburgh University, but couldn't bear the blood and suffering. The experience of witnessing an operation on an understandably distressed child, this was in the days before anaesthetics, of course, left him permanently traumatized. He tried law instead, but found that insupportably dull, and finally managed, more or less by default, to acquire a degree in divinity from Cambridge. A life in a rural vicarage seemed to await him when from out of the blue there came a more tempting offer. Darwin was invited to sail on the naval survey ship HMS Beagle, essentially as dinner company for the captain, Robert Fitzroy, whose rank precluded his socializing with anyone other than a gentleman. Fitzroy, who was very odd, chose Darwin in part because he liked the shape of Darwin's nose. It betokened depth of character, he believed. Darwin was not Fitzroy's first choice, but got the nod when Fitzroy's preferred companion dropped out. From a 21st century perspective, the two men's most striking joint feature was their extreme youthfulness. At the time of sailing, Fitzroy was only 23, Darwin just 22.